The Lowdown Chronicles. Meet your maker.
Hello, podcast freaks. Welcome to the new episode of Lowdown Magazine's very own program, The Lowdown Chronicles, Meet Your Maker. A new series that puts the well-deserved spotlight on people that essentially help to shape this ever-evolving pop cultural universe as we know it. In true Lowdown fashion, the illustrious circle of international guests, they won't be put together from one specific spectrum only, but it is assembled from the many tesseras the bigger picture is manufactured from. Which means contemporary art, skateboarding, music, fashion, film, graphic design, illustration, and everything in between. My name is Sven Fortman, aka 40. I'm the editor-in-chief of this highly influential publication named Lowdown. And with me today is Mr. Finn Greenall, a British gentleman based in Berlin that's probably known better as the singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, producer, festival A-lister, label owner, band leader, acoustic geek, and all-around red guy, Fink.
Thanks, man. That's a killer intro, dude.
It's not bad, right?
That is great. And all of that is technically true.
Technically true. Yeah. full disclosure, like we know each other fairly well.
Oh, man. Yeah, we go back like, I don't know, like we're talking like double digits.
I would say so. We featured you a couple of times in the magazine. Uh-huh. We DJed together back in the days. Basically, we know each other like when you were still working in Soho.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean,
that's a long time ago.
I mean, the beautiful thing, I guess, is that we met through the magazine. That's true. We met because you came to my studio in Hampstead, I think.
I think it was around the time like when you just put out like the label anthem, We Are Ninja.
Oh, yeah. So 99 then.
Hey, good times.
Good times.
Yeah. And obviously like we're doing this, I would say, award-winning radio show together on KCRW named the Fink and 40 Show.
I mean, we haven't actually won any awards yet, but I'm sure it's award-winning in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
At least.
They haven't made an award big enough for us yet.
That's true, actually.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, they still have to invent one.
Exactly.
How's 2020 treating you as an artist so far? Like, is it the new realities like we're all facing? Are they working?
It's a weird one, isn't it, 2020? I mean, at the beginning of the year, it was all about gigging like crazy, like any other normal year in my cycle. And then we had American tour planned and European tour planned, Africa tour on the books,
right,
for the first time. And, you know, we were talking Asia and, oh, you know, we had gigs to go. And then all of a sudden you haven't. So on the one hand, there was a real sense of euphoria at the beginning in February and March where you're like, okay, you're not touring. Oh, wow, I've got so much time to be with myself and be in the studio. And then, you know, a month later, you're just kind of like, So it's been really weird for all of us touring musicians. It's just been kind of like what we do has been removed.
True.
So what else do you do? And it has led to a large existential crisis for most of us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, If you base your ego on a round of applause every 5.5 minutes and you don't get a round of applause for 9 months, it's a bit of a hardcore like head spin, to be honest.
Yeah, but there's still live streams.
There's no applause though.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, or the cameraman or your wife kind of goes at the end of the song. It's kind of slightly different vibe. I mean, I've really embraced the time, and just like a lot of creatives, when you're faced with a large amount of empty space, you want to fill it with new stuff. So we've all been super busy doing other stuff. None of us have just kind of gone, great, let's go on holiday for 6 months.
Yeah.
Mainly because of the fear of like, well, what if touring doesn't come back? So who are you, basically?
And that's the thing, like who knows at this point, right?
Well,
like touring will come back like in one way or another, but I can't see it happening the way we are used to it, like over for the next 2 or 3 years, actually.
I mean, these cultural shifts are fascinating. If you're like a culture vulture and you like looking at like cultural cycles and the waves on the beach of life, and they sometimes they mark permanent shifts, like, you know, men wearing hats kind of was a thing for hundreds of years, and then all of a sudden it wasn't a thing anymore. And I'm sure if you were the hat maker, you thought, oh, hats will come back, you know, it's just it's just a moment in time, but they never did. Or like, you know, I mean, I really hope they do, and we all love going to see live music, and we all love live events and hanging out with each other. It's great. And us right now, yeah, we've moved all our touring to 22. So I mean, 21, it just doesn't sound really cool to think, okay, I'm going to be on an airtight bus where the windows don't open with 14 unhealthy guys playing a different city every night. You just think, dude, yeah. I can't even imagine that right now. Like, I've seen this year, I've seen 3 cities maybe total, you know? And yeah, like normally I'd see more than that in a week. So yeah, for now, you know, we're all just dealing with it, as is everyone in every creative industry that involves like collaboration. It's all of it, right? Like, okay, that element has to be changed and worked with, you know?
But this kind of like new extracurricular activities you were talking about, you know, like in your case, you know, like you were basically like building up young artists, you're doing masterclasses, or you're doing the occasional score and stuff.
Yeah.
In comparison, like, does it feel a bit like a scam almost compared to what you're usually doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it's just as real as playing a gig. I mean, the beautiful thing about helping young creatives is you get that real kick out of it, of like, there is something I've learned. It won't necessarily lead you to like financial success or like a Porsche Carrera or something. I've certainly written a few songs, and I've certainly done a few gigs, and I've definitely, you know, been in the music industry since 92. So I've seen like everything change. I've seen the whole landscape completely get flattened and rebuilt in that time.
Right.
So maybe those of us that are a little bit more longer in the tooth can kind of go, hey man, well, when I started doing all this, there wasn't even a mobile phone. So things can change, life can change, you know, like Instagram. I remember driving in my car like last year and playing like a live radio stream on Bluetooth into my car. I'm just thinking, wow, none of this existed when I had my first car.
That's a very positive way on looking about these kind of things.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure, man. I mean, I'd love an old car with a tape deck in it, but then you got the problem of like, well, I haven't got any tapes, you know, or at least all the tapes I do have are kind of like hip house. And
like, good times.
Good times. And like, you know, so yeah, I really try and remain like really wide open-minded as to, you should never like, never cling to attachments. And one of those attachments is like routine and habits. And if you're like a creative, you can get totally stuck in those routines too. Album promo tour. You can get, maybe it's going to be a different vibe. And working with young creatives is great because they don't have the baggage that you've got. So
right.
In a specifically musical way, it's like the new kids in the music scene, they don't even look at album cycles. They don't even really consider tours. It's different.
Not.
It's more like, what's our content rollout going to be? As opposed to, you know, who's plugging the record to Austrian radio? They're more like, who's making my Instagram, you know, splashes for this campaign? It's like such a different way of looking at things. So songs are getting shorter. Intros are getting cut, choruses first. Even the nature of songwriting itself has changed in the past 5 years. Or, you know, going back full cycle to the kind of mid-60s, early 60s, where it was all like, start with the chorus, 2.5 minutes, fade it out, that's enough.
Yeah.
We're back there. If you listen to like if you're in a taxi and you listen to like A-list radio, anywhere in the world is pretty much the same playlist now.
That's true.
And you know, a radio edit used to be 3:30 was the kind of your outer edge of a radio edit. Now it's like 2:20. You've got to just get on with it. There's no fat at all. It's like the attention span is definitely shrunk. I mean, we all said that when it was like MTV has shrunk the attention. There's an MTV generation, their attention span is like 4 minutes.
For sure.
Now it's like 1.5 minutes, you know? It's kind of, you can look at it and be like, oh, that's really bad. You know, in this climate, Pink Floyd would never have been signed and, you know, so on and so on. But yeah, they would. They'd be signed to an indie.
Yeah, no doubt about it, man. Yeah. So what do you imply? Like, basically, like that, if you want to basically like pull something positive out of this whole situation, like that the lockdown thing and especially for artists, like the way they have to readjust to the situation, is it for some, I wouldn't say the majority, but for some like a necessary slap in the face?
Yeah, it's a bit like these extreme situations culturally always act as a kind of extinction event.
Yeah.
So like you can, maybe the most obvious one was punk. It just came along and utterly swept the board, completely changed the entire industry. All of a sudden people like Luther Vandross and, you know, the kind of, you know, easy listening kind of mainstream pop music was completely redundant in the space of 6 months. And they were just left kind of looking around being like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah.
And so rap changed everything in that sense. All of a sudden, if you're making party music and you're not hip to rap, then it's like, dude, where have you been for the 80s?
True.
And maybe lockdown, okay, it's not a musical genre, okay, but it is a moment where we all have to have a bit of a reflection and be like, okay, what's going to happen after?
I mean, we will see, like you can already feel it this year. Basically, this lockdown thing suddenly became a new genre, right? Because all of a sudden you have this extra sessions and you have, like, I don't know, alternative versions en masse and...
Everything's gone acoustic, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
God,
man.
I'm so sick of acoustic sessions.
I don't want to hear another cover version, does he get, man?
I know. I mean, it's a bummer for me. I'm an acoustic musician and I'm thinking of doing some covers online. No! But it's like, no! No more Beck covers. Beck's not allowed anymore. Yeah, true. I mean, it is. I think next year's musical output is going to be very DIY. Mm. And I think that on the visual sense, it's going to be very paradise. Sort of centered. It's going to be very sort of hyper realistic, sort of the future is an incredibly bright neon fantastic place.
Yeah,
like pure escapism. Whereas on a musical side, it's going to be more like, oh dude, I made this in my bedroom because like I can't gig to afford to pay for a studio to record it properly, and it's going to be that times everybody.
But what will happen to dance music? What will happen to clubland?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I still,
because basically, you know like it seems at this point as if it's like an obsolete genre, basically. I mean, as much as they want to entertain the idea, like that people will have like a little party in the kitchen and stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, like it's a different kind of thing as if you're experiencing it with like hundreds of people in a proper club.
Man, I totally feel for my dance brothers
Absolutely.
And sisters. It's just, I can't imagine it. I mean, it's a bit like I'm in a metal band and you take electricity away from me. You're like, well, technically you can still all hang out in the rehearsal room and play your
neo folk.
It's not going to be good, is it?
Nah.
So I really feel for my dance friends, man. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I still get sent a lot of promos.
Yeah, that's the thing, right?
Because of our radio show and stuff. Mm. I still get all these dance promos and man, I mean, I just think, how do you motivate yourself when you think, okay, my medium is a sweaty club with some strobes at 4 a.m. in Berlin on a Tuesday night, and now that's not there. Where is your muse now?
Yeah, true.
Is it all, because dance music, you can't really go internal with it. It's not really kind of like, I'm going to sit at home and listen to deep house on my headphones for 2 hours. You just don't want to do that. Lots of people do, I'm sure, but because even when you do that, you're thinking, oh, if I was in a club right now, if I was on a, you know, beach, if I was I'd be the sunset right now. You know, you always like give these moments to it. And
yeah.
I mean, it might be the end. It might be the end only because your audience, there's going to be a big gap there.
Mm.
There's going to be a 2-year gap of people that didn't hit 18, go clubbing for a year, make all those terrible mistakes that are awesome that you do. And then now you've always got the reference to, okay, when I hear, I'm going to think, oh yeah, do you remember that time?
That's true.
Like all 1,000 people going like, rah! You know, no, you won't remember that time. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Hard to tell, man. Like as you said it, like I'm feeling so sorry for the many, many, many artists like I know, like who are working in this business, because it is a business. And yeah, like it must be the most frustrating situation ever.
I mean, part of me, full disclosure, when I do talk Zoom chat with DJs living in their mansions, I do kind of go, oh, there's no DJ money now, is there? I do a little.
That's so mean.
I know. I shouldn't say camera, should I? Well, I absolutely am. But when I do it, when I do a gig, and I remember I was talking to a dear friend of ours, Mr. Jones, and he sent me a picture of his load-in for a gig, and it was a USB key and a pair of headphones.
Yeah.
And I sent him my load-in for my gig, where I was going to earn like a quarter of what he earned that night. And it was a truckload of equipment in flight cases, like virtually filling up a venue. So yeah, part of me is kind of like, I know, you know, that's another thing that's been lost, which is the whole kind of, yeah, Friday night I'm playing Budapest, Saturday night I'm flying to Beijing, a Sunday night I might just do Tokyo, and then I'm flying back on Monday, doing a remix on Tuesday, then I'm flying to Mexico on Wednesday. You know, all that flying stuff is gone.
Which, so, in a way, is a good thing, obviously.
It can be considered a good thing for the environment, but if you're like that guy, you can't travel, you can't DJ, you can't...
Yeah,
like,
then you're fucked.
You can't do that thing that makes you who you are. It's this existential crisis. I think for the dance music guys, I think maybe they're maybe feeling it the hardest. I mean, it's difficult if you're a young indie band and you go, okay, we're in a band, we all sound pretty good. We're going to play every toilet in Europe and someone's going to notice us. And it's like, okay, now you can't play any toilets anywhere, so no one's going to notice you.
But the benefit is like, since they're hopefully staying together, like they will be a lot tighter.
Yes.
Because they rehearsed their asses off.
I know. But, you know, bands at that early stage of their career, they tend to implode real easy. It's all fun, it's all great, it's all dreams. And then if it turns into a grind of like, okay, let's go to the rehearsal room and rehearse the same 10 songs again for like no reason.
Yeah.
It can get really demoralizing.
Yeah, sure.
So it's weird how in this really interconnected, communicative world that we're in, you can feel really isolated. You don't know who's out there. So if you do a gig, you know that 500 people or 1,000 people or whatever, 20,000 people like you in Berlin on Wednesday because they were there and they came and saw you and they clapped, and you can go, okay, I can do the math on that. But when you move everything virtual, you just don't know.
That's true.
I mean, you can look at your Instagram feed and be like, how many people liked my picture of my breakfast? Okay. But that doesn't give you an idea of how am I doing?
That's true.
I mean?
Of course.
And I think as creatives, we often have to deal with the fact that there is no grade. Like it's, you know, none of us are living in, well, some of us are living in mansions and have fast cars and stuff, but most creatives are doing it for the love of the creativity.
Absolutely true.
So we sacrifice the kind of, you know, cars, holidays, sick days, you know, money, just because we want to do what we do. And but for most of us, there is no tick or grade or exam that you take every year or raise or promotion or anything like that. It's just constant, like, a world of being creative. So, yeah, it's hard to know how well you're doing. You might be doing immensely well. I have no idea. Like Charles Mingus, I read his autobiography. It was fascinating because he was washing dishes in a restaurant when he realized he was famous.
Because he
wasn't. In his own world, he was just unemployable musician washing dishes in between gigs. And then in this really fancy restaurant, and then some clients of the restaurant sort of saw the doors swing open and saw through the doors, oh my God, they were from Europe, they're European jazz fans. They saw it was Charles Mingus like doing the washing up. Oh my God. And they went in there and was like, oh, you're amazing, you're Charles Mingus. Oh my God, you're like a legend. And then he realized, I had no idea, but I'm a thing in France.
Is this a true story?
I think it's in his autobiography.
Then it should be true, yeah?
His autobiography, the stretches the truth, I think, quite a lot. But I can easily imagine that, you know, you work in isolation, you put stuff online, you don't know what that many streams means or how many people have listened to your music or like it or love it or whether it's changed their life or whether it's just a background elevator music.
Yeah.
It's quite that's going to be the thing that I think most creatives find the hardest to deal with this lockdown thing. It's the whole, I don't know how well I'm doing or how badly I'm doing, which is often much better feedback than, oh, dude, that's really good. It's much better feedback. Oh, dude, that's really shit. And then you're like, oh my God, it is, isn't it? You know? No, you always remember the bad reviews. You never remember the good ones.
Seriously?
Absolutely. Like, there's no, in my life, for sure. I don't read my reviews anymore. Absolutely not. If you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones. And I don't want to believe the bad ones. So in the early days, you read all the good ones and be like, yeah, I am. Voice of a generation, genius, you know, once in a lifetime artist. And then you read the one review that goes, God, he's so full of himself. What a dick. And you go, I'm so full of myself. What a dick. You really focus on negativity. Yeah. I think it's human nature.
I beg to differ, actually.
Oh, you beg to differ?
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, like, as you just mentioned it, like in, obviously, I believe you when it's the case, if it was like this in the past, but I think like this reading the bad reviews could also really help, like to I don't know, like reflect on things you might have not seen before.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm talking to a journalist, but I don't need a journalist to tell me that. You know, it's like I know where the flaws of my albums are, so it's up to me to try and make them better in the future. And I don't know.
So it's basically like just like you're working strictly like under your own parameters.
Well, like all constructive criticism is gratefully received, and I have a circle around me of people that love to speak truth to power. You know, whether it's your partner or your manager or your label or your you know, your band or whoever it is. And then you've got yourself who should be your greatest critic, you know. You need to be your number one fan and your number one, and you are your greatest enemy at the same time.
Right.
So when I need, like, when I write a song and I think it's really amazing, which I do every song on the day that I write it, I think, yeah, this is like up there with, you know, Dylan or Lennon.
Yeah,
absolutely. This is like a masterpiece. And then you go to bed and you wake up the next day with a new head and you go, okay, you know, it's not a Lennon.
But it's decent.
It's okay. But then you play it to people, you get all these different reactions. It's great. But when it comes to like the finished article and you get the reviews, there's nothing you can do about it now. So if the journalist goes, yeah, I see what he was trying to do, you're like, because I can't go, oh, you know, you're right. Give me a second. Give me another day. I'll just fix that. It is what it is. So I don't know. I have a really strange, I have a strange relationship with feedback, because the world I live in is all judgment. All the time. If I wasn't into the judgment process, I wouldn't release it. I'd just make music for myself and play it to myself and go, that's great. And then I'd go to work doing something else. But because I release it, I'm releasing it to judgment. But
this rings fairly true to any world, right?
Any world where you put your work out there. Absolutely. You know, and you want people to love what you do, but it shouldn't be the motivating factor for you to do what you do. Because ultimately, the only person that needs to love it is you.
Obviously, like, that's the ideal state. But you know what we had earlier in this conversation, you know, like that, you know, the times, they're changing so rapidly fast. And all of a sudden, you know, like all these different platforms on the internet, like they're becoming a new kind of currency almost. And so obviously, I think especially for a young artist, like it's basically you have to play after these kind of mechanisms that these platforms offer, right?
Yeah, you have to go with the ones that suit you.
Yeah.
Like, like there's a kind of artist that shouldn't go on TikTok. I'm one of them, by the way. But then maybe there's a way of me making TikTok me without it being rubbish. Like my relationship with Instagram.
Right.
Like your new relationship. You've been on Instagram for a week?
I love it, man. I'm so into it.
You know, you have to find your own way of doing it. It's not about posting messages of your breakfast and stuff. It's you make it your own. Like you find your own way to make that platform true to you without you trying to be something that you're not. I think we can all sense that, like, especially in this you know, post-content world, we're all very much hyper aware of filter stroke no filter. We can sense it a mile off when someone's not being genuine, because we naturally gravitate towards genuine. And now, even more so than ever before, because we get to see so much fake, that we really yearn for genuine. Mm. And I think that's reflected in cinema, art, music. What we want is the realness.
Yeah.
You know.
I find this really interesting in terms of, for example, like what you did over the last year or two. You know, what we had earlier, like, you know, we basically like met also through DJing, or we became even closer friends through DJing back then. And obviously, like, then you made this transition musically and stuff. And then what I really like is that on the one hand, you do like the odd vocal part for, you know, Clubland, so to speak, for artists and me or Marcus Vogel and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they work perfectly well, I think.
Well, I really love...
On the other hand, but on the very same year, like, you're going on a solo acoustic tour in the US.
I know.
And basically, but it still fits together somehow, it's a paradox almost.
Well, as my manager said to me, you know, wisely, he said, you know, if you're singing on the record, it's a Fink record. So, and another thing he said to me, which is really true, which was like, nobody's coming to the gig to see you play guitar, by the way. So why don't you stop giving a shit about how your guitar sounds and start caring more about how your voice sounds? Yeah. What was the question again? Can't remember. I was thinking about me so much, I forgot.
As usual. that basically doing an acoustic solo tour through the US, which was really like an expensive one.
Yeah.
And that really was all over the place.
It's so good, yeah.
That basically this can happen in the same realms as delivering the vocals for club acts.
Sure. Well, the club thing is like...
Do you still feel occasionally like this kind of like fire?
I do. And I still, you know, I was a DJ for ages, you know, Ninja Tune in the 90s. It was like the temple of turntablism, you know. It was just like, you know, if you were into the concept of this avant-garde new wave of lifestyle, which was clubbing, wow, there isn't an act. There's nothing to look at. What do? You know, you dance. What? That sounds really, really weird. It is. It just doesn't sound weird now at all. But it was a massive thing for me. And I was really, really into this whole political side of it all, the whole vanguard, the whole electronic music. In my opinion, in the 90s, was this brave new frontier where anything's possible as long as it fits in with this extremely prescribed, you know, box. But no chorus, no song, no singer, no band, no verses, no press shot, no name. You know, it's like God is a DJ, but you're not. But like God, you never get to meet him or know who he is. It doesn't matter who he is.
It's more like a spirit kind of thing.
Yeah, it's just more like the DJ is just a conduit for your experience. I don't know. It just felt extremely punk to me, that whole ethos that we are. Not only are we, like, let's say, to go back to the punk analogy, you know, they're using drums and bass and guitar and singing and verses and choruses in a twisted way. Well, the electronic revolution of the 90s was like, yeah, all of that's gone. You know, why would you be a drummer? What's the point of that? You know, that's what my parents liked that from the 50s. Didn't Elvis have a drummer? It's 1990. Come on, you know. So being, I really felt, and as you were as well, I've got many I was there moments from 90s clubbing land.
Yeah, sure.
First time I heard drum and bass, first time I heard acid house that really moved me, first time I heard, like, you know, you played me LCD Sound System for the first time in Watergate.
True.
First time I heard Losing My Edge, you know, and I remember these moments so clearly. So I think it's like, you know, like if you've ever done psychedelics, then after that, you've always got a reference to psychedelic movies, music, whatever. You can kind of get it if you've done psychedelics. And I think if you're from this euphoric E-generation electronic 90s moment, then you're always going to be yearning for that kick in or that breakdown, you know, you're always going to want that, oh my God, this is the best music in the world moment. So yeah, I'm still like, I really get it. I mean, I don't go clubbing anymore. I haven't been to a club for like, I don't know, years. I mean, I did try and go clubbing when I first moved to Berlin, and I went to a lot of clubs and I really fell back in love with techno, like big time. It's great. It's great here. But I went to clubs so many times to go see a DJ that I really wanted. Oh, dude, he's going to play some amazing, amazing stuff. And a lot of the times it did feel like a business transaction, not like a musical moment that's going to change my world.
Okay.
Although I did have one of those in Berlin with Sven Veit.
See?
I know. He was like, it was amazing that night at Watergate. It was amazing. It was crazy. It was really wild. So yeah, I like to do, I love doing vocals for my friends in electronic music if they want me to, because I remember being a DJ and wanting vocals to play with. And in my day, it was, you'd find an a cappella on a 12 inch and you'd mix it over the top of Aphex Twin track or something,
yeah.
Or Missy Elliott over, like, you know, whatever. And now with the fact that we've all got technology, we've all got a studio in our laptops, we can just email each other the results. Yeah, it's like, well, it's an honor to be asked, and it's a pleasure to do it. But again, it's a songwriting, discipline, because the parameters are different. When you're clubbing,
when you're
clubbing, you don't want to hear a song about how much I miss, you know, the rain or something. I don't know, some kind of Fink song. You know, you actually want, I don't know what you want, but yeah. I don't really see, like, there's a massive disconnect between, maybe it's because there aren't many singer-songwriters who do like acoustic stuff, who haven't this electronic heritage that I've got. Maybe that's why it feels a bit weird.
I guess so, yeah.
But I love, like, the cleanliness of electronic stuff and the purity of dance music, because it's only got one agenda. It should only have one agenda, and that is, does it work on this dance floor at this time in this city? That's the agenda. So there's lots of music made for Berghain. There's lots of music made for Watergate. I'm just naming Berlin clubs now. But, you know, there's, when I was DJing in London, there was music made for Cargo and music made for 93 Feet East and music made for Brixen and Basement Jacks down in Brixen and stuff. So
that's the thing, you know, like when it comes to these kind of scenes, you know, like the music is produced to have like an imminent effect on you.
Absolutely.
And you know, like when it comes to, I don't know, like music you do, for example, like if you missed it 10 years ago, you might discover it like 20 years later and all of a sudden think it sounds fresh and be completely into it, which hardly will happen like with dance music, I think.
That's, you know, nice link, dude, Radio Gold there, because that's one of the reasons that's one of the reasons I moved out of dance music into like the music I make now, is because at the beginning of dance music, I was completely in love with the fact that there is no shelf life. This music is for right now, and it's for May 1997, and in June 97, it will be as irrelevant as every other record in this set.
Mm.
And I was addicted to that constant, like, I don't know, like, it wasn't even consumption, just that constant nowness. I was totally addicted to it. And then I had some epiphany experiences with live music that kind of changed everything for me in just the space of a couple of months.
Like what triggered this kind of effect?
I had, like, basically I was DJing a lot for Ninja Tune, and I was international as well. So I was day jobbing it in the week for the majors, working in promotions, in vinyl. So all the vinyl would come in. I was one of the guys that would be like, these DJs get this record, you know, as that guy. And at weekends I'd fly off somewhere and DJ, like Berlin or like Hungary or like Austria, wherever, you know. And in the pre-mobile phone management days, you know, before DJing was like a lifestyle choice where you can get paid, it was more just community-based. You get That's to true. Know your Austrian mates or your German mates or your French crew, you know. And it was really great, but I was starting to get ground down a little bit, starting to get bored of the treadmill of, like, New records, new set, do a set, do a gig. Everyone liked it, got really wasted, got on a plane, came home, did it again. And then 52 weekends later, I'm like, I'm still kind of in the same spot, but a bit more knackered.
Mm.
Remember the woman at the bank who is nearest to my apartment? I'd be coming into this bank with like a shoebox with so many random currencies in it. And I'd be like, oh, hi, yeah, I just wanted to make a deposit, please. So there's some like Danish krona, there's some like Polish zloty, you know, there's some... It was that they, I think they thought I was some kind of international drug mule. And I think internally I probably was for quite a long period of time.
Yeah.
I was getting bored of clubbing. And that's really scary when I'm sure every creative has this, or I hope they do, because it's a really learning experience where what you do is everything of your whole life. I love music. I love making it. I love being it. I love listening to it. I love buying it. I love everything about it. And then all of a sudden I'm just bored.
Mm.
But then you're bored of your life. It's not like I'm bored of like having sandwiches for lunch. Okay, then I'll have something else. If what you love is all encompassing and then you fall out of love with it, you are kind of like, there's nothing left. And so I had this moment, and also I used to be quite guilty, I think, of my partner would also be 50% of my ego.
Okay.
So I was never single because it meant I was only half. I was only half.
Yeah.
My glass was half full at that point. So these things all came together at the same time. I was bored of clubbing. I was bored of DJing in bars and clubs and all that bollocks. Really tired of it. Didn't really see what the next thing was going to be. You know, everything seemed to have been rinsed. In 2001, it was like Two Steps been done. Jungle's been done. Garage has been done. Yeah, I don't know. Minimal hadn't happened yet. Villa Lobos hadn't redesigned how long a set can be yet. I was just like, what happens next? I don't know. And then I went to a Radiohead concert. They were playing OK Computer live at a gig called South Park. And they were supported by Beck doing a solo acoustic version of Sea Change. The weekend after John Lee Hooker had passed away. So we threw a few John Lee Hooker covers into the mix. And for me, that's now looking back, that's like holy grail moment. But at the time I was just like, yeah, dude, I'll come to the gig. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, have you got any weed? Great. Okay, let's go watch Radiohead. I hear they're quite cool, whatever.
Mm.
And then at the end of that gig, I was so dumbstruck at how awesome that whole experience was. And I just thought, man, I haven't had one of those experiences in a nightclub for as long as I can remember. It just doesn't happen anymore. I want to quit everything I've got, day job, record deal, the lot. And I just want to be a roadie on that tour. Like just to be with these people and have their experiences. Okay, now I know what a roadie does. I'm so glad I didn't do that. But you know, it was a massive epiphany. And I thought, okay, you need to register this as a moment. Like what does this mean? Because indie is like your enemy. You know, like being in a band is like what? And now you're thinking, oh my God, that looks amazing. And then I saw System of a Down a couple of weeks later play the Astoria in London, which is a tiny club, on their first album, on the SOAD album. And man, the energy in that club, and it was just like a Wednesday. It wasn't even like festival headline that everybody's been waiting for. For them, it was just a Wednesday. Gig in London, tomorrow we'll be in Paris. And the energy in that gig was just like, oh my God. I've never experienced that in electronic music.
If you take this experience and what you just mentioned, you know, like that all of a sudden, like you reach this point, like where you were coming really bored of this whole thing, like club culture, et cetera, et cetera.
A little, yeah.
When I look at your career as like the singer-songwriter thing, then for me personally, like everything seems to have been built up towards Hard Believer.
Okay. You know,
like all the albums before, like they were all super cool.
Mm.
And there was like on the first there was one hit, the second had maybe like two hits, and so on.
Right.
And then Hard Believer all of a sudden like
hits was with a little H. It's a little H, yeah.
And with Hard Believer all of a sudden there was an album which basically was hits only.
Hitsville.
Exactly.
It was a hitscape.
did you then was it a conscious decision then to do an album like Resurgam, because all of a sudden then you reach this and okay, done. Now I'm bored.
No.
Let's do something completely different.
No, it wasn't like that at all.
Nope.
It just happened to fail. I didn't want that either. But
in your mind, it was on the same road as Heartbeliever.
I thought. Well, this is taking a tangent. This interview, isn't it? When I wrote Heartbeliever, I think it came out in 2013 or 2014 or something. I wrote half of it in LA. I was living in LA. I was writing music for soundtracks.
That's the thing. Excuse me for interrupting. Like, I remember before you settled down in Berlin, like, you entertained the idea of either moving to Amsterdam or LA instead, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, but LA does something to you, man. You know, even if you think you're immune to its evil charms, you're not.
Mm.
And that's why so many creative people end up in LA thinking, I'm different though. I'm way too cool to be affected by, like, oh, you want to have lunch? Oh, I'd love to. Oh, no way. You think I could write with her? Wow, I could buy a house if that way. And then all of a sudden you're in. Mordor has got his eye on you. I mean, it's the only place in the world, if you're a musician, where you can have a meeting at lunch and you're a millionaire by the time you've driven home. It doesn't happen in Berlin, doesn't happen in Paris, doesn't happen anywhere else. It can happen every day in LA.
Still?
Absolutely, of course. So, you could be asked to do a songwriting job in a studio, and you get there and it's, you know, Ariana Grande sitting there, and you're like, okay, my life's different now. I like this. Yeah, you know what? It happened to James Blake in a way. Anyway, that's another story. the Heartbeliever album has a kind of commercial edge to it. One, because I was like naturally going there anyway. I was arcing out of being a singer-songwriter who self-produced, like referencing my kind of, I do everything myself. That's the 90s ethos. That's the bedroom producer in me. I've got my own desk and my own, you know, I produce all my own stuff.
Yeah.
And then I did this album called Perfect Darkness, which we recorded in LA, and I realized, oh, if somebody else does all of that, it sounds way better. And you suddenly like raise your game a bit and you kind of puff your chest out a bit and go, okay, I need to raise up to this level.
Mm.
And then Heartbeliever, I was kind of leaning into that, you know, I was just feeling like I want to be a band now. I don't want to be the guy who carries everything. I want to be the guy in a band.
Mm.
And so we were becoming a band. So Heartbeliever was like a band record. You know, we wrote it together and we recorded it together and we did it in LA and it was all like, oh, dude, really cool. And the songs were written for our tours because the tours had slowly gone from 200 people in your entry level shithole. They were starting to get up to like, which gigs have we not sold out on the tour?
Mm.
Why haven't we sold out Leipzig on a Tuesday? We need to work on Leipzig rather than, oh, dude, we sold out Paris. Can you believe that? You know, it turned.
Yeah.
And it meant that you could start writing songs going, okay, I'm going to play this in Paradiso in Amsterdam. It's going to be sold out. It's going to be amazing. And then you're going to strike into this song. Huh, what's it going to sound like?
Mm.
And so you start writing into that. And maybe it's like you see it with all the bands you love when they become stadium sized, and all of a sudden the next album you're going to hate because you're not the guy that goes to the stadium gigs, but it'll be the one with the stadium riffs on it, and you'll be like, God, I hate this band now. Mm. And they're just writing into their experience of, hey, dude, we're going to walk out on San Siro and play this. What's it going to sound like?
Yeah,
and it's not going to sound like, you know, Fake Plastic Trees, unfortunately. It's going to sound like a Coldplay track. So Resurgam, the album that came after Heartbeliever. Yeah, I went through a lot of personal stuff after Heartbeliever. And I moved to Berlin as well. I sold my house, I sold my car, and I left the UK, and, you know, just everything kind of changed. And I didn't write the records. I thought I was writing the follow-up to Heartbeliever, but it turns out I wasn't. Mm. I was writing something else. I mean, there are some really great tracks and I love it. And it opened my relationship with Flood, who's now my sonic mentor. And I really needed a sonic mentor. I needed a producer who was like a grown-up to sort of give me some new rules.
Mm.
And rules like, it's finished when it's awesome. as opposed to a deadline is just a suggestion. These classic...
That's so decadent.
I know, it's great, but these are classic anti-establishment memes. Mm. That is the reason why Flood's produced Nick Cave, U2, PJ Harvey, Depeche Mode, because he's that guy. They don't want the guy that's like, the label says it needs to be done by July, so July we're done. He's the guy that's be like, fuck the label. It's done when it's great.
He's the one getting paid, so obviously he's saying that. So.
Well, not necessarily. No, not necessarily. As a producer, you might think, okay, I'm going to get paid for this producing this record, but it doesn't mean it's going to take a week. You might want it to take a week, but it might take 6 months. But you don't charge by the hour.
Yeah, but 6 months is more like Happy Monday style. So
I don't know, man. I mean, you know, from the moment you start writing to the moment you mastered a record as an artist, that can be an 18-month arc sometimes. But look, you know, unfortunately, I'm not Chris Martin or like Paul McCartney, where you can just on cue write a massive hit. Mm. That's also a really great song, you know, and every time I try and do that, I utterly suck. I just suck at it. I mean, it's just like making techno. Everybody listens to techno maybe and sort of goes, I could do that. My child could draw that. And it's like, yeah, but he doesn't though, does he? Mm. It's like every time I try and make a credible techno track, I epically fail. You know why? Because it's way harder than you think. Mm. It's not just a beat and some noises. Mm. It's just not. Same with writing songs. So, yeah, I thought I wrote the follow-up to Hard Believer when I wrote Resurgam, but actually Resurgam, I think I now look at as a bit of a stepping stone record, personally and artistically. I needed to do that record to do the next one, and the next one is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's the thing, like with Bloom Innocent, you know, like I would say, like, that's basically like your Pink Floyd moment.
I love it. I was wondering what you were going to say there. I was hoping Magnum Opus, but no.
Nah,
Pink Floyd moment.
Not yet, man.
Which Pink Floyd, though? What, the rubbish stuff or the good stuff?
Dude, like, I only know Dark Side of the Moon, obviously.
Is it? Okay, yeah, so that's my...
I have very little knowledge about music.
That's a perfect place to be for a music journalist. Bloom Innocent was a delight.
Like when it comes to the transition from Resurgam to Bloom Innocent, which has like a very different vibe, I think.
It does.
And I love, by the way, and usually I'm not a fan of it, like that basically that there's like four different versions existing of Bloom Innocent.
There's three official releases now, because I wanted to explore the fact that, it's not me being lazy, I promise, I wanted to explore the fact that the song as a song can actually wear different outfits.
That's the thing, like I would never ever consider this as being just lazy and like, you know, let's twitch and turn like a little things there to make it sound different. It's just like, for me it means like that the original songs like have so much potential that you can easily twitch and turn them and make something really utterly unique out of it once again.
I mean, maybe this comes from my remix culture background, maybe, that I'm like...
Probably, yeah.
Because when I did this album called Horizontalism, which was a remix album of Hard Believer...
Yeah, which is...
which is kind of out there.
A little surreal, basically.
And it's very Berlin-inspired, but actually it was made just down the road.
True.
Yeah, it was made over there. It was because Ninja sort of said, oh, you should do a remix album. It was just an easy way of creating more product and it didn't cost much money. And, you know, you can just get a bunch of remixes done. And I was kind of like, I was really inspired by this Massive Attack album where Mad Professor did No Protection. And the weird thing about that record is when I bought it, whenever it came out, 94 or something, 95, I don't know, one of those. I thought it sucked because I wanted to buy another Massive Attack record.
Yeah.
And it definitely wasn't, you know, Massive Attack, you know, it was Mad Professor. Mm. And subsequently, it's become one of my favorite records because I like the concept of giving another producer the whole record and be like, do whatever you want. And then you get something new. Mm. So with the Horizontalism, I did that. Instead of getting other people to remix it, I just remixed it myself on tour, on the road, in Tinker Towers, you know, to try and give the whole remix album concept a beautifully thorough, like, go. Mm. I love that record because I really did go to town on it and put a lot of time into it. But I think after making a kind of alternative pop record like Hard Believer, making a Berlin drone wave electronic record of interpretations of that record maybe was, I don't know, like... it confused a lot of people. It didn't confuse me. For me, the journey
exactly,
was like, all made
that's
sense.
The thing.
But some people were really
definitely confused a lot of people. That's for sure.
And then I did a traditional blues album,
which confused even more people.
I know. And then I did Resurgam, which was like a bloated rock.
Some people were going mad.
Yeah, it was like, dude. Yeah, absolutely.
But that's the thing. Like, you know, like when you follow the journey from the, let's say, like horizontalism, Hard Believer takes to Resurgam to Bloom Innocent and the blues album in between. Mm. I think, like, especially like now with Bloom Innocent and the different version, which are out there.
Three different versions, Pop Pickers. We've got the acoustic version, which is re-recorded, not just, you know, totally redone in a new studio, live.
But that's the thing, like for me, it feels like that you can, by now, you can totally start from scratch. Whatever your next album will be.
Yeah, well,
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I know what I want it to be. But this is the problem with creation. You know, I remember before I made anything, you would think that someone like Mozart would sit down and have it all in his head and be like, right, I've decided the next thing's going to go like, you know, we know that's not the case with creation.
Of course not.
Nobody does that. Unless you're writing some generic thing that you've written loads of times before, you know, okay, A minor, C, G, got it, we'll do that. But I think you can't, as a creative, you know roughly where you're going, but you don't know what it's going to be like at the end. Otherwise, you just know in advance. You'd lose the will to live just knowing what you're going to do in advance. You start a song, I reckon Beethoven and Bach and all these guys were the same as us. You'd start a song, you get a cool riff, oh, that's kind of cool. Write some lyrics, oh, they kind of work. Put some drums on, oh yeah, that's kind of awesome. You don't sit down and go, the drums are going to go like this, the bass is going to go like this, the guitar's the song's going to be like this, the chorus, you kind of feel it out.
Hopefully.
That's my vibe.
Hopefully, yeah.
And, you know, I think, like, I'm sure the old classical dudes, I mean, a lot of it was kind of business transactions, you know, it was work for hire, right? But,
yeah,
you know, I think in the modern creative era, we're not doing work for hire. We find ways to pay us to do exactly what we want.
On the other hand, like, do you think that you reach this point, like, where you overthink music a little bit too much?
I think I've reached...
And not let it, like, flow as it should?
I think I've reached the opposite point.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I started, I really overthunk everything.
Yeah.
Everything had to be perfect. Every session had to be perfect. Everything had to be how it needed to be. Now I'm like the total opposite of that. Bloom Innocent was essentially recorded live in a studio with three mics. That's it. My sound card has four inputs. And, you know, a Flood mixed it down for me because he's amazing and he's a genius. But I'm deliberately trying to let go of all of that judgment and preconception and stuff in order to make better music. So the Bloom Innocent record is one of my favorite albums only because I really did let go of all that stuff. I'm not writing singles. I'm not writing focus tracks. I'm just writing whatever I want to hear, you know, and it's just I had to really learn to let go. Hashtag learn to let go.
Is it really hard to basically get to this point to let loose of not thinking about the focus tracks, which then basically will guarantee that it will get it will reach a different radius?
Yet it is difficult to do that. Like, it's difficult to rid yourself of any attachment that you've got. It's always hard. But at the same time, your idols didn't care what you thought. So you have to kind of channel that. Tom York's not writing his next album, and for me to go, oh, you know what? I want some 40 plus guy living in Berlin to think this is really cool. He's not thinking that at all. He's just going, I'm doing what I want to do, and if I think it's cool, then it's cool. And then I'm going to love it even more because he doesn't care what I think, and that's what I want. So I really tried to go there. I went there with my blues album and I went there with this Bloom Innocent record. It was really kind of like, look, if I like it, then that's the main thing. If this is going to be an expensive hobby, which is what Resurgam, the album Resurgam kind of felt like, it felt like, wow, you're going to be paying for that one for a while. It's like, I'm still paying for it. Then it's got to be, you got to love it. And it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. I mean, obviously you want, deep down, you want people to go, ah, it's lovely, I loved it, it touched me, it changed me, whatever your gig is. But you can't, that can't be part of your creative process, because then your creative process is like, is the water's muddied by your anxiety about what people are going to think. So you'll never be truly creative. You're kind of forever writing to the brief of somebody that you'll never meet.
Can't it be both?
No.
Why not?
Because music made with anxiety for the results is inferior to music made without anxiety.
We had this discussion before, you know, like when, you know, like when you're always questioning yourself, doubting yourself, like obviously like there's a different vibe to it. Like there's a different nuance coming to the table then.
Well, look, doubting yourself is useful because it raises your game. Mm. If you're listening to your track and you're thinking, oh, that chorus isn't very good. It's not very good. When you listen to your favorite Bon Iver track, you don't for one moment ever go, ah, that lyric's not very good, is it? Or, no, I think you should have chosen a different snare for that. Never. Mm. You're left with no question marks. And it should be the same when you listen to your own music, surely. It should always be like, there's nothing I can make better here. This just sounds perfect to me. Even if that's, you've recorded this track on your phone, it's like, actually, I can't, that sounds perfect. I don't need to go into a fancy studio and redo it, because it's never going to sound better than that. Mm. That's the truth right there. I mean, you will go to LA and record it in a fancy studio, spend 20 grand on it and end up releasing your phone recording. I guarantee it. But you know, if you really only make creative decisions based on what people are going to think about you, you're not really going to be the kind of artist that you want to be. You might as well be in marketing. You might as well sell detergent. You'll make way more money and have a much more relaxed
time. That's very true, unfortunately. Yeah.
You know, if you're the creative director of Unilever, trust me, your bonus is better than if you're, you know, an engineer in a recording studio.
And that's why the CEO of Spotify was so right, that it's all about the sheer quantity.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a tricky spot, I think.
Of course he is.
He's in a trick. There's a, you know, it's very difficult to say anything these days about anything, you know, if you're in that position of power. Spotify's done a lot of great stuff for a lot of artists. What a lot of artists might forget potentially, although I'm not judging anyone and they can think whatever they like, is that it wasn't so long ago that you would have to pay a record store to take your record. And then they'd buy your record off you for €3. They'd put it on the shelf for €15. And you had to give them a free CD for every 3 that you sold them. And you had to pay them to rack it in a good spot. Mm. How does that sound better than it cost nothing to put it on the platform, nothing for you to put a link on your social media to the track, you don't have to make anything, send it anywhere, and you've got just as much chance as Drake of getting a play. I know I'm being super super naive here, but you know, in theory,
on paper it works. Of course
it's like the stores, I'm not talking about indie record stores, obviously I'm talking about the big major chains. They had a monopoly over the music industry for decades that was obscene, and I think streaming has realigned that. You know, there are no longer massive record store chains. Mm. And as an artist that was in that world on both sides of the fence, as both the guy trying to get racked and the guy buying racking for the majors, I'm like, I don't miss that world at all. I'd much rather take the level playing field, even though it's an infinitely large playing field, of a streaming site over, if you want to get racked in HMV, you better bring 35 grand to the table in a bag, and then we'll put you on the front of the store, which I think is disgusting, you know? So I always thought that was wrong. I was so upset when I found that shit out, because I was working as a junior marketing guy, and I was running this urban project. I think it was Ludacris, actually. A track called Rollout. Mm. And then I got offered the pack, the urban pack for a major retail chain.
Mm.
And I'm like, what do you mean you buy that? I thought the retail chain listened to all the music and went, hey, the best stuff this month is this one and this one. You got to get it. Special offer. It's going to be great. And I thought that was curated.
Mm.
No, you just buy it. You can just buy that urban pack and then you rack it. I just thought that was, because all my life I just thought that they were curating this stuff, helping me out. It turns out it was just who could pay for it.
That's only a rough trade, man.
Well, I mean, there's so many weird angles these days, but you know, Rough Trade's one of the greatest record stores in the world, and the indie record stores, the ones that have survived the Book of Eli level of Armageddon that the industry's gone through, they're amazing now.
Mm.
I mean, indie stores now are just like, they're like heaven. You listen to records, you can buy shoes, you can buy a book, you can
have a coffee.
I mean, Rough Trade East in New York is like the coolest. There's even a venue.
That's the thing. Yeah. I mean,
it's like the coolest space you could imagine in the world.
It's basically like what you always thought, like the world High Fidelity opened. You know,
oh
like,
my God, yeah.
Basically like now we finally reached in terms of independent record stores.
I mean, there's almost all the indie stores from my youth aren't there anymore. They were little stores that sold niche. Sidetracks in Park Street, where I bought my first KRS-One record, My Philosophy, or Replay Records up the street, where I bought Fast Eddie's Acid Thunder on White Label, and Depth Charge in York, where I bought Nas's Illmatic, for example. none of these shops exist anymore, you know. But Resident Records in the UK and Rough Trade East in London, Rough Trade New York. These are like dream destination stores now. I mean, the survivors have got it, like they've just created a destination that's just, I love. I want a coffee and I want to listen to these records. Okay, you can have that. You know, they don't have to be a separate experience. I mean, Berlin has changed a lot, but there used to be a record store on every corner, especially where I live.
True.
A lot of them have shut now, but there'd be like, that one sells minimal, that one sells slightly harder minimal, that one sells maximal subhouse, that one sells like, you know, niched up to the Italian Italo disco with a touch of, you know, Balearic in the mix or whatever. It was so niche, it was great. But so we've had to, you know, the shops have had to, you know, broaden their horizons a little bit. But I think this, going back to the Spotify question a little bit, Spotify is a bit like window shopping, because you don't actually get to keep, you don't get to keep it.
Mm.
Nothing in your iTunes is yours either, by the way. It's all a lease. But, you know, it's a bit like window shopping. If you're really into music, you'll listen to it on Spotify and be like, oh man, I love this record. You listen to it again. You listen to it 10 times. And then maybe you'll go like, oh, you know, if I want to have this in my life, I'm going to order the vinyl from HHV or whatever independent retailer you get your vinyl from, and then it's in your life forever. Next time you want to listen to music, you might look down at your pile of records and pick one and play it, and it'll just be part of your life. So if you're not really into music, you're not really that into it that you actually buy it. Like,
true.
I don't go to the cinema, for example. I love movies enough to buy them. I'm not sure. So, you know, a lot of people don't like music as much as I do, so they can buy a Spotify subscription and dive in whenever they like without the commitment of, me and my drummer Timmy talk about this all the time. When you bought an album when you were a teenager in the 80s, I would wash my dad's car 4 times to get the £5 to go to the W.H. Smiths and buy one album that month. And so you better make it good, because it's the only one you're going to have that month.
Very true.
And if it sucks, well, that's it. No other choice. If you bought a Heaven 17 record, unlucky. If you bought a Human League record, if you bought Thriller, jackpot. You know, we know these records back to front because we listened to them. You know, we wore them out. My copy of Thriller, I don't even know if it would even play anymore. And you can do that with Spotify. You can have it on repeat forever for nothing if you like that. But I think, you know, a lot of people don't need to like music so much they need to buy it. They just want to kind of browse it. And it's nice that there's an option there, because before, what would you do? Like listen to the radio all day? Listen to like this highly curated, incredibly polluted business decision all day? Or maybe you'd ask your mates, have you heard any good records recently that I could borrow or something? Whereas Spotify is kind of, there's an algorithm for that now. I know it's super controversial, but sometimes it gives you a suggestion that's like, I like that. I would have never found that if AI hadn't offered that to me.
Yeah, true.
Is that wrong? Is it wrong to fancy Siri as much as I do?
I guess so. It feels a little bit.
It feels a bit her.
Yeah, it's like you have this kinky relationship with her at this point. I think.
I think it's like, honestly, you know me, man. I'm a very optimistic rainbow guy.
Yeah, totally, man.
And I'll find a silver lining even in the middle of a vortex of a monsoon as my house is getting destroyed. I'll be like, yeah, but it gives me a chance to think about where I am, and you know, I get that from my mum for sure. But I think, you know, it's very easy to bash Spotify because it feels like it's free. But it isn't. If you get the numbers up, you get paid. When people say there's no money in the music business, they're just wrong. There's huge corporations that are making billions every year in the music business. You're just not making that kind of music. I mean, ask, you know, Calvin Harris if there's any money in the music business, and he'll be like, well, dude, I haven't got time to chat right now. Come on my private jet and we'll have a word. You know what I mean? Whereas if you ask that avant-garde Swiss rhythm drone wave artist, is there any money in the music business? They'll be like, no, Spotify's ruined everything. I can't sell a record now.
So basically it's business as usual.
Yeah, maybe it is, dude. You know, I mean, I was even okay with like the whole Napster Armageddon moment. I thought, look, if MySpace is going to destroy, if Napster and MySpace are going to destroy the music industry, at least it might introduce people to my music. They'll buy a gig ticket. And I'll make more money from the gig ticket than I would from the album sale by a mile anyway.
Yeah, but so you know, Lars Ulrich, back to differ.
I know, and he fundamentally regrets that.
Think so.
Oh yeah, Lars definitely regrets saying that, you know. I mean, he also regrets selling his Basquiat, but that's another story. I mean, regrets, you know, but he regrets that. But that was a moment where, you know, it's just like, it's okay to make wrong decisions. You know, drummers do as well. You listen to my drummer, you know, a whole gig's worth of wrong decisions. It's like, you know, it's okay to change your mind. I mean, I thought that, you know, like I say, you know, if you illegally download, like research from like 10 years ago was saying, if you illegally watch movies, if you torrent movies, you're way more likely to go to the cinema than people who don't. And if you illegally stream music, you're way more likely to buy music than people who don't. So where's the downside here? Actually, people who illegally download movies end up buying cinema tickets, and you make way more money from that ticket than you would from them not doing it. You know, controversial, okay. But, you know, it was... like iTunes free download of the week when iTunes was like ruling it. iTunes is the new record label 2006. Oh my God, the world is going to end type moment. It was like, man, when I got that, it changed my, I got 250,000 downloads on Pretty Little Thing in like a week, and everything was changed in like a heartbeat by giving it away. So maybe I see Spotify as like, I'm kind of giving it away, but if it means that you buy a gig ticket or you buy the vinyl, or, you know, if it leads you into a relationship with me and what I do, then it's a good trade. If there's millions of you. So if there's 500 of you, then I definitely need to rethink the model. But you know, you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
So on this happy note on piracy and illegal downloading, shall we come to an end with this conversation?
Sure, if you want to end on that note.
Like how long have we talked? Like an hour plus or?
72 minutes.
Bloody hell, dude!
Fucking hell!
We can just talk forever. It's rubbish. I haven't even started.
That's the thing. Like I have asked maybe 3 questions, and there's like 30 more.
Okay, well then pick one. Are they numbered?
Of course.
Of course they are.
They're numbered in like an alphabetical order.
All right. So I'm gonna say, hit me with 23.
You always like dub. Why is sideshow over? I want more sideshow.
Sideshow. Legal reasons.
Again?
Yeah, I mean, it was all like, oh, dude, I mean, I love making dub and I love dub. Dub is, reggae is a church. It's a holy, it's holy music. It's like sacred moment. It's like, you can't fake it. You can't exploit it.
Mm.
It's just an incredible moment of it's like an epiphany. Bob Marley should be on the money in Jamaica. He really should. I mean, I don't know who that guy is. It should be Bob Marley. There's no doubt about it. Mm. Reggae is a really sacred form of music, and it led to dance music, and it led to some amazing culture shifts. And it's from a little island. I mean, that's amazing. And dub is amazing because I'm into electronic music and producing, and everything I learned about production in the 90s, I learned from listening to King Tubby records, because you could listen to a King Tubby dub record and you'd hear him muting and unmuting channels. Mm. It was amazing. You'd be like, all right, so the backing vocals are on a different track to the lead vocal. I didn't know that. Or like, or the horns are on a different channel to the snares and stuff, because he's just put a delay on that and it's not on that. And I learned everything from these dub records. So my sideshow project was like, okay, well, I really love dub and I really want to make it. And I've got a great band who also seem to be into it. So let's make some sideshow records. And then I signed a deal for it, and they wouldn't let me out. They wouldn't let me buy out of the deal. They wouldn't let me out of the deal. They won't let me have any of their music back. So that's that. Sideshow then, you know, hit the dirt as part of some, you know, legal fucking bullshit. But, you know, I have tried. When I was in Jamaica a few years ago, I did think, hey, I'm in Jamaica, I'm going to do another sideshow record. And it didn't feel the same. The thrill was gone. Sometimes it's just nicer to just like something as opposed to try and do something. So I really like my epic dub and reggae collection. I really, really love it. I don't feel like I need to add to it with my interpretation of it. I'm perfectly happy with it as it is.
How come you're so modest all of a sudden?
Is that modesty?
A little bit. Like there's this moment of really being clear about things.
Well, the dub, the reggae, and the reggae is a very, if you like reggae, you and you're not, you know, a Jamaican, say, like myself, then you like it for all of these right reasons, but without the same context. It's like the 13-year-old white kid in me who got into Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Mm. I obviously didn't have the same context when I listened to the message as a kid growing up in Queens in 1983. I was living by the seaside in the outskirts of Bristol. And, you know, my parents did not understand my musical choices at this point, and nor did I. I don't know why I like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. But when they came on Top of the Pops, I thought they were the best thing ever. And my mum and dad were very much like, why do you like this music? It doesn't make any sense. It's dark, shouty, you know, political, inner city stuff. And you live by the seaside and everything's great. And I'm like, I don't know, but it's great because you don't like it. So I like it even more now. I learned a lot from Public Enemy, you know. In the early days, I learned all this cultural referencing that I had no idea, like stuff I didn't even know you're allowed to think. Like Elvis is simple and plain.
Mm.
I think, God, you allowed to say that? Oh yeah, maybe he is. I don't believe that, but you know, dub is a beautiful thing. And I when I got into it, you can't even study it. You can't even analyze it. It's just a feeling. It's
beautiful. That's the thing. Like dub always was, always will be something really sacred.
Yeah.
And the same what you said before about techno, like that. When you hear it and on paper, it seems to be like so easy to make.
No doubt.
No way, man.
I mean, the same rules apply to dub. As in, if you think too hard, you've already blown it.
Yeah.
It's not about thinking. It's about feeling. That sounds so cliche, but it's so true. Same with acid house. There's four components to acid house. There's the beats, there's the acid line, and maybe you're allowed one or two other things. That's it. Mm. One of them could be a kick, and one of them could be a, and that's it. Same with reggae and dub. It's a minimal combination of things. If you think too hard, you're going to ruin it. You're going to, you can't intellectualize something like that. It's just faith. That's what it is.
And the best things happen from that.
True that, you know, have a little faith. And have a little faith in yourself, you know. It's important to believe. It's important to believe in yourself. Otherwise, you end up just doing stuff that you think you should do. But you should be doing stuff that you feel that you know you should do.
You should have told me that like 20 years ago.
Yeah, I wish I told myself that. So there you go.
Mr. Greenall, a pleasure it was, man.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for enlightening us all. With your wisdom.
I'm glad you think you were enlightened.
And then, till then.
Till then.
Bye.